By Worsley's estimate, they had made a good 7 miles to the northwest. Though the distance itself was not impressive, the fact that they had finally taken to the boats was the fulfillment of a dream. After 5.5 months on ice, they were underway at last. Doing some good for oneself, as Macklin put it. They dropped off to sleep almost immediately. "Crack ho!" The watchman's cry rang out within minutes after the last man had turned in. The weary men stumbled out of their tents, some of them without even bothering to dress. But it was a false alarm. There was no crack, and the men crawled back into their sleeping bags. Toward 11 o'clock, Shackleton became strangely uneasy, so he dressed and went outside. He noticed that the swell had increased, and their flow had swung around so that it was meeting the seas head-on. He had stood watching for only a few minutes when there was a deep-throated thud, and the flow split beneath his feet, and directly under number 4 tent in which the 8 forecastle hands were sleeping. Almost instantly, the 2 pieces of the flow drew apart, the tent collapsed, and there was a splash. The crewmen scrambled out from under the limp canvas. "Somebody's missing!" one man shouted. Shackleton rushed forward and began to tear the tent away. In the dark, he could hear muffled gasping noises coming from below. When he finally got the tent out of the way, he saw a shapeless form wriggling in the water. A man in his sleeping bag. Shackleton reached down for the bag, and with one tremendous heave, he pulled it out of the water. A moment later, the 2 halves of the broken floe came together with a violent shock. The man in the sleeping bag turned out to be Ernie Holness, one of the firemen. He was soaked through, but he was alive. And there was no time to worry about him then, because the crack was opening once more, this time very rapidly, cutting off the occupants of Shackleton's tent and the men who had been sleeping in the caird from the rest of the party. A line was pitched across, and the 2 groups of men, pulling toward one another, managed to bring the halves together once more. The caird was hurriedly shoved across, and then the men leapt to the larger floe. Shackleton waited until the others were safe, but by the time it was his turn, the pieces had drifted apart again. He took hold of the rope and tried to bring his chunk closer. But with only one man pulling, it was useless. Within 90 seconds, he had disappeared into the darkness. For what seemed a very long interval, no one spoke. Then from the darkness, they heard Shackleton's voice. "Launch a boat!" he called. Wilde had just given the order. The Wills was slid into the water, and 6 volunteers scrambled on board. They put out their oars and rowed towards Shackleton's voice. Finally, they saw his outline in the darkness, and they pulled up alongside his floe. He jumped into the Wills, and they returned to the campsite. Sleep now was out of the question. Shackleton ordered the blubber stove lighted. Then he turned his attention to Holness, who was shivering uncontrollably in his soaked clothes. But there weren't any dry garments to give him, because their only clothes were the ones they were wearing. To prevent Holness from freezing, Shackleton ordered that he be kept moving until his own clothes dried. For the rest of the night, the men took turns walking up and down with him. His companions could hear the crackling of his frozen garments and the tinkle of the ice crystals that fell from him. Though he made no complaint about his clothes, Holness grumbled for hours over the fact that he had lost his tobacco in the water. Chapter 2 At 5 a.m., the first hint of a brightening sky marked the ending of the night. It was April the 10th. The weather at daybreak was hardly encouraging, overcast and hazy, with a strong easterly wind driving intermittent snow squalls across the icy water. Neither Clarence nor Elephant Island was visible, and Worsley could only estimate that they lay generally to the north, between 30 and 40 miles away. The easterly wind had blown new masses of ice around their floe, so that once again they seemed trapped. But there were signs of an opening, and after breakfast, everything was made ready for a quick start. Shackleton decided to lighten the boats by abandoning some ice tools and several cases of dried vegetables. Shortly before 8 o'clock, the pack began to loosen, and at 8:10, Shackleton gave the order to launch the boats. The sea was broken by a nasty chop, which made the boats lurch heavily and rowing extremely difficult. But before long the ice began to open up, and within an hour or so they found themselves in a vast expanse of ice-free water, so broad they could hardly see the pack to either side. It was a welcome sight, after more than a year of looking at nothing but ice. Shackleton had the word passed to hoist sail. The Caird was fitted with two masts for a main and a mizzen sail, plus a small jib in the bow. The docker carried a single lug sail, and the Wills mounted only a very small mainsail and jib. The boats were thus hardly fit sailing companions, and this fact immediately became apparent when the sails were set. The Caird caught the wind and heeled to port, drawing steadily ahead of the other two boats. Though the docker was somewhat faster than the Wills, the difference was slight, and neither boat could sail into the wind. There was nothing for the Caird to do but to hang back so as not to outdistance the others. Toward mid-morning, the boats came to a boundary of pack ice, stretching in a long, closely packed line, apparently following the current. The floes here were old and stately veterans that had survived years of pressure and had emerged at last from the Weddell Sea to melt on the fringes of Antarctica. Their edges, instead of being fresh and sharp where they had been newly broken, were worn and eroded by the water. For more than an hour, the three boats proceeded west along the edge of this line of ancient floes, and then, shortly after 11 o'clock, a passage was discovered, and the men rowed through. They realized immediately that they must be in the open ocean. Ironically, here was the moment they had dreamed of ever since the days at Ocean Camp. But the reality was vastly different from the dream. As soon as the boats emerged from the protective barrier of the pack, they were struck by the full force of the wind, and a high, breaking sea was running down from the northeast. Freezing spray burst over them as they tried to beat their way to the north-northeast under sail. Time after time, icy blasts whipped them across the face, and the penetrating wind seemed all the colder because of their lack of sleep. In the docker, Ord Lees and Kerr slumped down onto the pile of sleeping bags, miserably seasick. Yet the men complained very little. They knew that somewhere through the mists, probably not more than 24 miles to the north, there was land, and they were actually making for it, and getting closer all the time. When it came time for lunch, Shackleton permitted a hearty ration of biscuits, cold sledging ration, dog pemmican, and 6 lumps of sugar. Early in the afternoon, however, the wind increased considerably, and the boats began to take on water at a dangerous rate. For more than an hour, Shackleton kept to a northeasterly course, hoping that the boats would somehow prove equal to the seas. But toward 2 o'clock, he realized that it was foolhardy to press on, and ordered them back behind the protective line of the pack. The boats came about and sped southward before the following wind. Within minutes, they had reached the edge of the pack, and they proceeded westward, looking for a floe to which they might make fast. The largest single piece of ice they could find was what Worsley described as a floeberg, a thick mass of dark blue pressure ice about 35 yards square, which rose in some places to a height of 15 feet above the water. It was floating alone, isolated from the rest of the line of pack, and it had obviously been adrift for a long time. The seas had eaten around its waterline, leaving an overhanging girdle of rotten ice. The perils of the sleepless night before were still altogether too vivid in Shackleton's memory to risk again. The party would have to spend the night in the boats. They pulled up alongside the floeberg and drove oars into the ice. Then they made the bow lines of the boats fast to the oars, and the boats lay off to wait for darkness. Within minutes, however, the wind freshened out of the northeast, and the sea picked up. The boats began to bump heavily against one another, and they threatened to uproot the oars which held them to the floe. In addition, the wind swirled across the surface of the berg, catching snow from its surface and hurling it straight into their faces. After about a half hour of this misery, Shackleton had no choice. If the men were to sleep, and they had to sleep, There was no alternative to camping on the ice. Reluctantly, he gave the order. The boats were manoeuvred alongside the Floeberg, and about half the party scrambled onto the ice. The stores and equipment were quickly passed up. Then came the ordeal with the boats. The rotten overhang around the edge of the Floeberg was steep and treacherous, rising an almost perpendicular 5 feet out of the water. Thus the boats had to be hauled almost straight up while the men pulled from a safe distance back from the edge. The Wills was first, and she was raised without incident. The Darker was not so easy. She was halfway up when the ice gave way, and Bill Stevenson, one of the firemen, plunged into the numbing water. A half-dozen hands pulled him to safety. The Caird was last, and again the overhang broke. Shackleton, Wild, and Hurley were just able to grab hold of the boat before they fell in. It was 3:30 before the boats were safe, and by then the men were very nearly exhausted. They had hardly slept for 36 hours. Their hands, unaccustomed to rowing, were blistered and a little frostbitten. Their clothes were soaked from the spray in the boats, and when they unrolled their sleeping bags, they found them wet through. But all that mattered then was sleep. After a supper of cold dog pemmican, milk, and 2 lumps of sugar, they wriggled fully dressed into their sleeping bags. A few men, before they closed their eyes, put forth one last bit of effort to record the day's events briefly in their diaries. Worsley wrote, "By my reckoning, we make today, northwest, 10 miles, and the current should run us well to the west before this strong easterly breeze." And Hurley recorded the one thought that was uppermost in all their minds. "Pray God, this floe will remain entire throughout the night." By some minor miracle, it did. But long before dawn, they became aware that something was seriously wrong. At sunrise, they awakened to a terrifying spectacle of nature. During the night, the wind had risen almost to gale force, and from somewhere to the northeast, great quantities of pack had drifted down on them. Now it extended unbroken to the horizon in every direction. Berg fragments and shattered floes in 10,000 different shapes obliterated the surface of the water, and out of the northwest, rollers, 30 feet high, stretching from horizon to horizon, swept down through the pack in long, implacable lines a half mile apart. At their summits, the Floeberg was lifted to what seemed like dizzying heights, then dropped into valleys from which the horizon was obscured. The air was filled with a dull, muddled roar, the low shriek of the wind, and the seas breaking hoarsely amongst the pack, along with the incessant, booming grind of the ice. Because of its size, their berg was drifting more slowly than the rest of the pack, which bore down upon it and pounded it on every side, while the surge of the swell was undermining it by eating away at the waterline. Periodically, decayed chunks dropped away from one side or another, and others were torn loose by floe fragments hurled against the berg by the seas. At each impact, the berg shuddered sickeningly. This was precisely the situation Shackleton had feared since the first appearance of the swell at Patience Camp. The berg was crumbling beneath them, and might split or upend at any moment. And yet to launch the boats would have been idiocy. They would have been splintered to bits in 90 seconds. The whole scene had a kind of horrifying fascination. The men stood by, tense, and altogether aware that in the next instant they might be flung into the sea to be crushed or drowned, or to flounder in the icy water until the spark of life was chilled from their bodies. And yet, the grandeur of the spectacle before them was undeniable. Watching it, many of them sought to put their feeling into words, but they could find no words that were adequate. The lines in Tennyson's Mort d'Arthur kept running through Macklin's head. "I never saw, nor shall see, here or elsewhere, till I die, not though I live 3 lives of mortal men, so great a miracle." Shackleton climbed to a knoll, 12 feet high at one end of the berg, from which he could see the limitless expanse of ice. Here and there, far away, a black line or a small dark patch revealed a lead or a pool of open water. The party's only hope was that one of these openings would drift down and surround the berg, making possible their escape. But time and time again, a lead would approach to within a short distance, then veer to one side or another, or vanish altogether as the ice closed up.